Thank you, Chelsea. Good morning, everyone. How are you all doing? Good. Hope you're having a restful, fun summer. We're continuing on in our summer mixtape series. And I was going to start with a little prank that we were going to go back to Revelation and some big cryptic passage, but I didn't have time to prepare that bit. Today we're going to be working through the biblical theme of the wilderness, reflect how Jesus, who was faithful in his wilderness experience, meets us in our own desert seasons. So we're going to start with the contemporary understanding of what the wilderness looks like here in the West. In the West, our understanding has gone from a large, uninhabited, wild place where we can extract resources and use those for manufacturing to a more solitary place, a place to unplug from the metaverse in our pockets, a place to rest. And so there are companies online that will curate or facilitate these experiences for a lot of money, but I think they look fun. Folks can go rafting, see bears up close, and take a helicopter to escape the tourists into these isolated places. What came to mind for me is Michael Scott in the Survivor Man episode, when he tries to survive with the suit he wore to work that morning and duct tape and a knife. And he has no survival experience, so he almost eats a mushroom, but Dwight saves him. Some movies that envision the wilderness that I think are more related to the biblical vision. There's Mad Max, the space desert of Mars in The Martian. There's Star Wars, the original trilogy. There's Dune. And so keep some of those images in mind as we move forward in the theme. One of the ways the biblical authors attempt to convey importance is through repetition and setting. Some well-known examples are heaven and earth. Heaven is God's space, earth is our space. There's the waters, which represent chaos. There's the garden that reminds us of flourishing and Eden. So repetition of setting or place becomes a sort of what the Bible Project calls a hyperlink. It's like a footnote, like on Wikipedia, those blue footnotes. You click it, you go to another page, and you can keep going down the rabbit trail for a while. And so it's like one of those investigation boards where there's some sort of mystery in the middle, and all these strings branch out. There's pictures, there's suspects or whatever. And we as the readers are trying to make sense of that evidence to try and bring coherence to the scriptures. And so the desert is one of those themes. There it is, goes in the middle. And we're going to explore that today. Like Pastor Chris in his trilogy on the history of Christian theology, we'll be jumping over many centuries of the wilderness theme as we move towards Mark's prologue. In the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, we start with the wilderness in the Hebrew, the Midbar, in the beginning. It's associated with chaos and decreation. In Genesis 1, the Spirit of God is taming and shaping the chaotic state of wild and waste because there's too much water for life to flourish. In Genesis 2, it's flipped. God brings springs of water to a dry earth for life to grow. In Genesis 3, Adam and Eve are cast out from the garden and into the wilderness, where they will now work hard to survive. They will now someday die and turn back into the dust from which they were made. Big time skip to Exodus 13 to 15. We see the beginning of Moses being commissioned and empowered by Yahweh God to lead the newly freed Israels into the desert and onto the promised land. In Numbers, which means in the wilderness or in the desert in the Hebrew, the Israelites wandered the desert for 40 years. as the grumbling, unfaithful generation. There's a shift from Exodus, from God's patient testing, to a severe judgment as they fail to trust him. In Deuteronomy 8 and 9, Moses preaches to the new generation to remember. Remember what happened to your ancestors who wandered 40 years. Be humble and stay faithful to Yahweh God, and you will flourish here. The late Ulrich Mauser, a former German New Testament professor, wrote this book called Christ in the Wilderness, which was the main resource I used for this theme. And Mauser highlights that the narratives of the Pentateuch, so Genesis to Deuteronomy, form this sort of foundation or primary source for how the rest of the Hebrew Bible engages with the wilderness theme. So in the prophets, the Israelites are accused of failing their end of the covenant, and because of God's judgment are sent into exile. But the prophets also contain hope that Israel's time in exile will end, and God will pour out his spirit in a new way. The poetry of the Psalms contains hymns of praise for God's deliverance in the wilderness, but also prompts the people to remember the wilderness years. The Psalms ask, will you, the people of God, repeat your ancestors' faithlessness, or will you, through faith, enter into the promise of eternal rest? There's also lament in the Psalms asking God to deliver his people from the affliction of the Sheol, the pit, all these word pictures that are associated with the wilderness. So throughout the Hebrew Bible, the wilderness is described as geographically desolate. It's dangerous. It's a place where you're stripped of your comforts. It's a place of decreation. Bible Project calls existence outside of Eden as being on the knife edge of life and death. Humans are conditional and sustained only by God. Desert is where wild cunning beasts dwell. Scorpions, owls, jackals, ostriches, and snakes. Interesting. The desert is seen through a theological paradigm. There's spiritual evil there. It's where folks go to be isolated for testing, or they're hiding. And it carries this eschatological hope that one day the current age where we are influenced and go through the desert, that God will bring renewal and there will be no more. The threat of the desert will be no more. Throughout the Old Testament, we also run into a tension that there's this holy God. He desires to commune with his people to partner with them to undo the curse of sin, yet he allows creation and his people to be subjected to chaos and to loss and to betrayal. And this brings us, we're going to take another big time skip. This brings us to Mark's prologue. Mark has a very direct writing style compared to Matthew and Luke, who have a lot more background on Jesus' childhood, how he was born, his genealogy, and all that. By the time Jesus finishes his time in the wilderness, in Matthew and Luke, the reader would have gone through 4 to 4.5 chapters. In Mark's gospel, the same beginning of Jesus' ministry, when he leaves the desert, only takes 13 verses, and his wilderness narrative is only 2 verses. Mauser claims that Mark has densely crafted his gospel account to engage with the collective memory of the original readers. So he's absorbed all those hyperlink patterns and allusions from the Old Testament, the repetitions, and along with other sources of his day, he's starting to insert his own hyperlinks in there. Mark's gospel starts with the beginning of the good news. Mark is taking on Genesis-like language and makes the political religious claim that Jesus is the presence of Yahweh incarnate. Mark adopts the word gospel, which I think we really associate with the evangelical faith that we hold to, would have been more associated with this historical, significant, novel event pertaining to the empire. Mark then quotes a prophecy from Isaiah 40, verse 3. This prophecy also blends Malachi 3:1. I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. And Exodus 23, verse 20. I'm going to send an angel in front of you and guard you along the way and bring you to the place I have prepared. John the Baptist then appears and comes out of the wilderness. Mark's gospel starts in the wilderness. The gospel of John is different. It starts with a heavenly view before creation. The gospel of Luke starts in the temple. John the Baptist has this aesthetic of camel hair, leather belt. He has this diet of locust and honey. And he's seen as an outsider from the establishment of Jerusalem, its cultural and religious norms. The significance of John's presence and his baptism is that he is a new or second Elijah. And Elijah himself was also a desert man who had a similar diet and aesthetic. John is the forerunner for something new. David Garland of the NIV commentary says, when John refers to a more powerful one coming, the audience would have naturally assumed that this would be Yahweh himself. So John is preparing the way for Yahweh God who will lead Israel back through the wilderness. Then a new figure comes around. If we were to temporarily blur out or redact Jesus' name from this verse, we wouldn't think much of this figure who just arrived on the scene. This figure is from a nowhere town, Nazareth, an area that was never quoted in the Old Testament. So the comparison I have for us of a random person in a random town would be a lady named Debbie Webby from Nordegg. No one would care about Debbie Webby except for her weird name, and that we delete that from our already full brain storage. I actually really like the pies at Nordegg, so anyways. But Jesus comes from the town of Nordegg to be baptized by John. Everyone else comes from the royal city of Jerusalem in the province of Judea. And Jerusalem was the spiritual, political capital of the Israelites. It's where the temple was, where God would one day bring his presence again. Commentators reflect how the roles or portrayals of Jesus and of the crowds at the Jordan River are upside down and contrasted. On one side, there's the holy land of Zion. On the other, the unknown, unholy province of Galilee. Many go to get baptized, but only one fully understands what is really being set into motion. Then there's the Jordan River, a long stretch of water from the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee. It's something like the distance from here to Calgary. The Israelites would have had the Jordan River stored in their memory as a place where Moses gives a sermon, the sermon to his people to remember. It represents the border or in between from the wilderness to the promised land. And the Jordan River was parted by Joshua, Elijah, and Elisha as a symbol of their power through Yahweh. Mary Healy, in her commentary on Mark, says John the Baptist was interpreting the events of Israel's history as part of a divine plan, in which earlier events foreshadow and prepare for God's greater future purposes. John's baptism was a call for the Jews to reaffirm their identity as God's people, to come into the water with God once more, and symbolically re-enter the promised land through water. A new exodus was occurring, not from captivity to Pharaoh, but from captivity to sin. Commentators on Mark note that Jesus was getting baptized not because he sinned, but because he's fully embracing his incarnate presence amongst his people. This is John 1, that God incarnate has built a tent and sojourned among us, which is how Sarah Rudin translates it. Or God has moved into the neighborhood, as Eugene Peterson paraphrases it. This is Mauser again. Jesus is, from the very beginning, a member of a body of people whose heritage and predicament he shares. And, like Moses, he does not divorce himself from the sins of his people, but is bound up with them. With the crowds from Judea and Jerusalem, Jesus follows God's call to the wilderness as the place where Israel's sonship to God is to be renewed. By the time we get to verses 12 and 13, Mark has packed his prologue so densely that something needs to blow, something needs to give out. So something big is about to happen. Like Tom Cruise / Ethan Hunt in the Mission Impossible films, he is always seconds away from a nuke going off, from a villain getting away, some catastrophe, some mission failure. The reader expects some outcome that matches the intensity that's been built up in the story. Mark has portrayed big claims that Jesus is Yahweh God, that we encounter him as the overlap of heaven and earth, and that he's breaking into our history to bring redemption for humanity. There's this Gen Z phrase, he's him. Has anyone heard of that? No. I'm not sure if it's still in circulation, actually, so you might have to ask a Gen Z individual. But this is when someone in the audience sees someone do some crazy feat, like a crazy dunk, they catch a crazy touchdown, something seemingly humanly impossible. They're the greatest of all time, the main character, and everyone else is a random. This is essentially what Mark is claiming about Jesus. When Jesus thrusted into the desert, we have to ask, okay, is his fellow going to follow in the ways of his ancestors? Is he going to choose to act on the good in his own eyes? Take the fruit that's good in his own eyes? Or will he trust the words of God and pass the test of faithfulness? We see this narrative build up, this rising action later on when Jesus faces his last test in Gethsemane. And these are high-stake moments where the historic eschatological expectation of God's forward movement of history hinges on the faithfulness of one person. In the NIV's translation of the Synoptic Gospels, we read that Jesus is led or sent by the Spirit into the desert. And this kind of feels like a more of a gentle, soft push. In the NRSV, we see that Jesus is driven out, the same word for being expelled, forced away. And this is an unexpected turn of events for us, the readers. Jesus has this beautiful moment of affirmation with the Father and the Spirit. And instead of getting the green light to go ahead with his ministry, he's shoved into the eremos, the Greek for wilderness, for a time of peirazo, testing or temptation. Scott McKnight and Ben Witherington differentiate the words testing and temptation by the intention behind the trial. God puts us to the test to strengthen our moral character, and the devil offers us temptation in order to destroy our character. The Bible Project compares a test to an opportunity and temptation as a trap. So in this moment, Jesus is simultaneously being tested by God and tempted by the Satan, the accuser. And he is tempted with the same appetites and yearnings as his ancestors in the desert. The Israelites were tested with manna and water as Jesus was tempted to turn stones to bread. Jesus was tempted in his faith to trust God's word, but he didn't grumble. I think what's especially highlighted in Jesus' time of peirazo is how he would relate to power and responsibility. What did Jesus really believe deep inside his inner life and his heart about his work and authority? N.T. Wright, in his Mark commentary, claims that the Satan is questioning Jesus like this. Why not skip all the pain and betrayal, dealing with these clowns, the suffering that's ahead of you? Why don't you just take the glory now? It's yours, isn't it, anyways? God wouldn't want his beloved son to go down that path, would he? In this moment, we are brought back to Genesis 3 and the crafty serpent. The Satan is tempting Jesus with an out. At this moment, Jesus is most vulnerable in his identity as a son of God. This is the most valuable prime real estate that Satan is trying to infiltrate. This is Jesus' Achilles heel. His identity as God's son, God's call in his life, and what God wanted him to do. In his sermon on David and the wilderness, Pastor Tim Wolf says that the intensity of the desert always reveals what your heart is truly chasing, what you are truly thirsty for. In this moment, Jesus is about to go against the realm of darkness in his ministry of teaching and healing, bring the anticipated renewal of God's kingdom to where the Satan has brought decreation and slavery to chaos. And so the Satan in this moment is trying to land a preemptive strike before any of that can happen. In verse 13, we see Jesus reenact but also move forward and advance the story of God's people. Consider the beasts present with Jesus. Again, these are the wild animals who are symbols of spiritual evil. They must be cunning to survive. And also consider that Jesus' wilderness experience lasts 40 days. The number 40 being a symbol of transition in the Hebrew Bible, the great flood, the Hebrew spies scouting out the promised land, Moses on Mount Sinai, those were all 40 days. And then there's this part about angels, which personally I usually ignore. It's a bit weird. I question, why didn't the angels come sooner? Could he have used some backup earlier? Why did they come at the end? Commentators say that this divine encounter of angels who tempted Jesus is an echo of Elijah in 1 Kings 19. This is right after Elijah finishes up his Mount Carmel experience. He just brought through Yahweh a lot of fire and put to shame all the Baal followers of Queen Jezebel. And he's now on the run from that queen, and he goes to hide in the wilderness. He's having a hard time, which is understandable, and doesn't want to keep going. But an angel appears to him twice, tells him twice to get up and eat. The second time the angel says, get up and eat, or the journey will be too much for you. And he's given bread and a jar of water. And it's these provisions which sustain Elijah for another 40 days and 40 nights as he journeys to Mount Horeb, also known as Mount Sinai. Jesus is showing that he has taken on our human vulnerabilities. And in this moment of weakness, the Father provides an Edenic garden-like moment for Jesus that he might continue on in his journey. It's clear, especially from Matthew and Luke, that Jesus has passed through the wilderness, the devil's left him, and Jesus now officially begins his ministry. Yet Jesus continues to return to the wilderness. The eremos topos, which is the eremos used as an adjective instead of a noun, and now topos, or place in English, is the noun. Together, this is usually translated as a lonely, solitary, desolate place. And it's Jesus' practice of silence and retreat that has actually been a really important practice Christ's followers in church history, for the desert fathers and mothers who probably took the retreat too far. They didn't really come back. The monastic movement, the Ignatian and contemplative traditions. Some modern examples, Ruth Haley Barton, Tish Harrison Warren, and of course, John Mark Comer. Many have come to understand Jesus' time in solitude as a physical, mental rest when the popularity of his ministry was booming. Mauser argues that Jesus' scenes of triumph amongst the crowds are often contrasted and followed by his continued visits to the wilderness. This is to show that the final victory over death and the Satan hasn't been achieved by any one particular miracle or wonder, but that Jesus shows us what it's like for Israel to truly turn back to God and his will in all areas of life. The mundane, the mountaintop experiences, and the deepest valleys. Later in Mark, Jesus flips the geographic and theological understandings of the wilderness and provides bread for the 4,000 and 5,000 in an eremos topos. As we conclude, we've explored that people end up in the wilderness generally in four ways. They end up in the wilderness because of failure. This is Adam and Eve, evicted from the garden, sent into the desert. This is also Paul in 1 Corinthians 13, when he's trying to push back on the Corinthians' attempt of playing with fire in their faith, not to follow in the ways of their desert ancestors. Some end up in the wilderness because of oppression or danger. This is Hagar, who's fleeing the abuse of Abraham and Sarah. This is David running from Saul. This is the exile of the Israelites. And then there's formation and or testing. These aren't identical, but I think are closely related. Is God offering the Israelites a choice to receive his provisions and to wean them off their identity as Egyptian slaves? This is also what St. John of the Cross called the dark night of the soul, when we are stripped of our comforts, attachments, our egos, our disillusionments of reality and of God. And there's a fourth, and I think if we were to end before that, perhaps the wilderness motif would seem quite formulaic, sequential. You could be in the wilderness because of this or that. I stole my grandpa's iPhone or whatever, and at least I know what to do to be okay. I should probably reconcile with him. He might be a bit mad, but there might be a wilderness experience in that. However, as the church has historically wrestled with the problem of evil, the story of Job, there can be many moments in life when we end up in the wilderness for what feels like no good reason at all. I've called these the unplanned tragedies of our silly and absurd existence. Sometimes parts of life feel so unreasonable, so meaningless or absurd, which is how Professor Pastor Tyler translates it, Ecclesiastes, is when life's circumstances unfairly and violently thrust their way into our lives. Walter Brueggemann says that in these moments from orientation, things are good and nice, to disorientation, the chaos of life, that we are invited into the practice of lament. A historic practice for the church. And Brueggemann says that we are not without a guide for this practice. There are many psalms of disorientation and lament that truly show us how to engage with God honestly without the pretense that is usually our default language as we wrestle through the desert path. No one leaves the wilderness unchanged or unscathed. Think back to the harsh imagery of the wilderness. The wilderness is rough. It kills and wounds and can break the human spirit. There's the option to avoid and repress the pain of these wilderness seasons or the remembrance, the memory of them. But it's inevitable that you aren't the same person who first entered that season. We all have folks in our lives who are always mean, grumpy, overcritical. And God's grace on them and their life circumstances, but they didn't become like that overnight. Then there's also those who are scarred from the outside seem like shells of their former self, but yet they are people of wisdom to see reality as it is. They're able to take an honest count with their inner world, the way they hurt people, the unseen places of vulnerability that most of us try to cover with ego, and they are people of deeply rooted joy. This type of person is what the art form of icons in the Orthodox and Catholic traditions try to portray. An icon is, they usually have the big halo, and usually they're in other traditions of the church. We don't have any here, I don't think. But these are portraits of folks who have gone through life, the wilderness experiences, and have been formed more into heavenly-like people. In all the ways we might find ourselves in the wilderness, we are assured that Jesus has faithfully passed through the wilderness and all that it represents. Jesus has overcome the failure of humanity and our oppression to sin. On our behalf, Jesus has shown faithfulness to God's will all the way. He has shown us a way out of the permanency, the damnation, the meaninglessness that the wilderness seems to speak over us. One day he will fully renew creation and the threat of the wilderness. Jesus' wilderness experience is not in isolation from the Hebrew Bible, from the New Testament, or from the 2 millennia of church history. His wilderness experience is not in isolation from or detached from our lives today and this morning. So we are invited to bear our journey onto him. Jesus has given us his spirit that we might find him deeply present when our journey veers into the desert. Amen.